back to Shattering Mist. I think it was last Friday that we had a call from Anthony in New Jersey. Anthony said that he had gotten together a group of friends and that collectively they had begun working themselves through why they ought no longer be Christians, why they ought to reject Paul's testimony, and why they, most importantly, ought to come to know Yahweh, observe his Torah, which means to closely examine and to carefully consider Yahweh's teaching, and that as a result of doing so, it come a long way, but still had some questions. And so I encouraged Anthony to call back under that basis. Is that a reasonable summation of what you shared on Friday?
Yes, it was, Yada. Yes, it was. And I have a couple more questions, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm sure you've considered this before, but, you know, we've removed the title L-O-R-D, Baal, from our vocabulary. Even J-C or J-E-S or less, we've removed from our vocabulary. I mean, we'll say the name if we're talking to somebody to explain certain things. But here's the thing. We're going through your archives. I'm only on, I have to say, December of 2012, you know, we're slowly working through them. You went into detail about the word gospel, or more precisely, God's spell. And the first part, God, is, as far as I can tell, my research, it comes from a proper name of a Nordic or Norse deity.
And, let's work on pronunciation, just so that our listeners know. I didn't say it's God's spell, G-O-D-S spell. It's Gott's, G-O-T-T-S. Spell.
Okay.
The Norse deity and the Teutonic deity known as named Gott, G-O-T-T, is the basis of gospel. That's how we got, because, you know, it's not God's spell, it's gospel spell. And so it's a combination, the best, most linguistic researchers can do, of the name Gott, G-O-T-T, and the Old English word spell. And so that's the basis of it. It's not God's spell. Based upon the research I've done, there really isn't never has been a deity named G-O-D. There's been one named Gad, and there's one named Gott. But even in the case of Gad and Gott, they weren't well-known deities.
Okay, the reason why I was asking is because we were under the assumption that the word G-O-D came from that, so we removed that also from that.
No. Okay. No, that's yeah. And by the way, that is it's a really good question. I've done that on gone over to a number of shows. In fact, one about two or three months ago. The fact is that the Hebrew word for Almighty is Eloah. Yeah, Eloah is shortened to El and Elohim, Elohim being the plural of El. And there are a very significant number of Hebrew roots types that say because the instruction exists that you should not have the name of pagan gods on your lips, that you shouldn't use the English word God. Well, the fact of the matter is the English word God is not a name. It's a title. Even in English, it's a title. It's not a name. And but beyond that, I've done a fair amount of research, and you really can't find a pagan god named God, G-O-D. There's a Gad, and there is, but very poorly known, and there is a Gott. But then the issue is, then, what are you going to use for the title? Because there are gods in paganism known as the Mighty One or Almighty, and there is even a Canaanite god named El, which is the shortened form of Eloah, El, and then in the plural Elohim. And so that's not going to work, so you can't just transliterate the Hebrew word. And beyond that, Yahweh himself uses El and Elohim not only to depict his title, but also to depict a word to describe false gods. So if you can't say God, you can't say El, you can't say Elohim, then he himself would be violating his own testimony. No, God's instruction is that there are lots of names for false gods out there. Allah is one of them. Jesus is one of them. Christ is one of them. Jehovah is one of them. Shiva, Vishnu, on and on. And what Yahweh is saying is, don't revere, don't respect, don't proclaim a religion in the name of a false god. Grace is another one. Grace is the name of a pagan goddess. And so that's the instruction. Yahweh, throughout his Torah, uses, like, for example, in a passage we considered not too long ago, he spoke, in fact, it's in Yahshua, he says, one of the things that differentiates heaven from earth is in heaven there is no celebration or mention of the Asherah. The Asherah is the basis of Easter, and a lot of the Christian mythology comes from Asherah, and no sun god images. So he named the pagan god. Yahweh uses Baal throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms to identify Satan as the Lord. And so it's not that we can't use these names. It's just that when we use the name Lord, if we use the name Grace from the Latin and Roman gratia, the same goddess as the Greek charities or charis, that we ought to use them in such a way as to expose and condemn them as being false, just as Yahweh does. So if we follow Yahweh's instruction in this regard, we will speak Lord, but we'll identify Lord as Satan. We will say grace, but we will identify the graces with the gratia and the charities and the pagan religion. And so we will use those names, but we will use those names to condemn them as false, just as Yahweh does. You can never go wrong if you follow Yah's example. And as it relates to the English word God, because that is the closest translation of Elohim and Eloah in English, it's not a name, it is a title. It does not fall under the Yahweh's encouragement not to to revere and proclaim. By proclaiming, it means to advocate on behalf of false gods.
All right. Well, thank you for that wonderful explanation. I do have another question, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. Our group, we're in the understanding that the covenant is associated with or likened to a marriage covenant, that Yahweh married a group of individuals. I guess I could say it that way. Or
No. Yes, and then no. Okay. You mean, can I explain?
Sure.
Okay. The Hebrew word bereth, which is based on the Hebrew word be'eth. Be'eth means home and family and household. And therefore, bereth would be a relationship based upon home and family and household. Bereth is also the Hebrew word for marriage vow. And so, okay. But families are based upon men and women coming together in marriage and in love to conceive children and raise their family in a loving, protective home, which means that the whole concept of marriage and men and women coming together as husband and wife to become mother and father and to conceive and to raise children in a loving environment mirrors the concept of the covenant. So God designed us in such a way that our lives would mirror that which he was offering us. Now, while the word bereth means marriage vow, God is not married to his children. That's silly. But it does explain that there is that bereth is a promise. It's a vow. And that the vow is very similar to a marriage vow in the sense of a marriage vow. You promise fidelity. You promise love. You promise support. Those kinds of thoughts apply to the covenant. But the only individuals that, God will go off to and say that with Yisrael, that he considered himself married to them in the sense of that he is faithful to them, that he loves them. And then he says, you know, but because you've chased after the lords and false gods, I'm divorcing myself of you. And even when he is in the end, he is not remarrying Yisrael. What he's doing is, just as Hosea predicted, he is going from you are no longer my children to I'm readopting you as my my children. And it's, so that kind of explains the process.
Yeah, the reason why, because we were under the assumption, and this goes, you know, we're still learning, but that Yehovah married Israel, and that when Israel split the house of Israel, and then Judah, which is Judah and Benjamin, that Israel went in and never came back to the land. They assimilated into on the country, but yet Yehuda came into the land, so that Yehovah did not divorce. He divorced the house of Israel, but not the house of.
I've got to be really careful there because, and Hosea, what Yahweh is saying is that the relationship that he's proposing as the covenant is akin to a marriage vow. It requires mutual love, mutual respect, mutual investment of time, mutual fidelity. And so that's what he is equating it to. And he says, you know, this was the kind of relationship that we had. And he goes on to say, because of your behavior, you are no longer my children. In fact, he even calls them not my children. Now, he does not at this time, while he is besmirching Yisrael, which is it's Ephraim that he uses here. And Ephraim represents 10 of the 12 tribes. And those 10 tribes, shortly thereafter, were hauled off into Assyrian captivity. And, you know, many of them have come back, but they have all lost their identity as to what tribe they were part of. So there is Yehuda that represented two of the 12 tribes, Benjamin and Yehuda, that he said that, you know, I'm not yet divorcing myself of. And it's because he had work to do with them. I mean, this was written, you know, around 700 BCE, and in 33 CE, he still had work to do through Yehuda, which is the reason that he was not in a position at that time to divorce himself of Yehuda or to say of Yehuda, you are no longer my children. And so it kind of gives you a framework. And then ultimately, when the covenant is reconciled, it is reconciled between Yahweh and Yisrael, and Yahweh and Yehuda, reconciling Yisrael and Yehuda back together with Yah. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Shattering This. We're talking about the insights that are provided in the prophetic book named Hosea. It means he saves. It's speaking of Yahweh saving us. And let me conclude this, Anthony, by trying to put all this into perspective. There's an entire volume of Yada Yah, yadayah.com, that you can read about what God said. Every single word of Hosea is translated and described for your consideration. And what God is saying is that religion and politics, which were rampant in the northern kingdom, in Ephraim, had meant that those living in the northern kingdom had broken the conditions of the covenant. The first condition of the covenant is you have to walk away from religion and politics, walk away from Babylon. They were wallowing in Babylon in religion and politics, and Yahweh said, you violated the terms and conditions of the covenant, and therefore I'm having to expel you as my children. You've breached the terms and conditions. And he did not do the same thing at the time with Yehuda because he was going to use Yehuda to deliver the Messiah, the Messiah Yahusha. And so that is why he did not speak of them at the same, but then he did provide a prophetic testimony about when he was going to provide the remedy that Yahusha provided by fulfilling the first four invitations to meet with God in year 4000 Yah, 33 CE. And then he said how long after that before he would provide reconciliation, which he said would be 2 days from the healing point to reconciliation, which brings us to year 6,000 Yah, and so 2,000 years from 33 CE is 2033, and that's when Yahweh said that he was going to reconcile his relationship, and they would be known as his children again. And so we find Yahweh returning on the day of reconciliations in 6,000 Yah, 2033 on our pagan calendars, and reconciling his relationship with his covenant children, both Yisrael and Yahudah. So that's the purpose of all of that testimony.
Can I interject one thing?
Sure.
In the Torah, Father talks about the fact that he draws a picture, a teaching, that if a husband divorces a wife, or let's say
he can't go back to her.
Right, he can't go back to her.
Mm-hmm.
So our understanding, and this may be wrong, our understanding at this point is that that's what happened to the northern tribes, and then
he's not, but read. Yirmiyahu, this is a thing that's brought up by Hebrew Ruth people all the time. Read Yirmiyahu 31. He's not remarrying Yisrael or Yehuda. He's reaffirming his covenant relationship with them, which means he's father, their children. He's not remarrying Yisrael.
I see. Okay.
So that's how you resolve the conflict that is presented by Hebrew Roots people is in Yahshua 31, where he is talking about renewing and reaffirming his covenant on the basis of his Torah, by the way, full integration of his Torah within those who meet him on that day. He is saying that he is reaffirming his covenant with them, the covenant relationship is father-child, not husband-wife.
Thank you so much, Yada, for all the
information. Okay, yeah, my pleasure. Call back again. Love your questions, Anthony.
Thank you. We have
Paul, who is called in from Ontario, that has a perspective he'd like to share. Go ahead, Paul.
Hello, Yada. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Very good. I haven't talked to you for a long time. I have a couple comments, if I may, and then a question or maybe two.
Okay.
I have hundreds of questions, but you cannot answer. Anyways,
first
of all, your message, I still call it shocking. You know what I mean? Like,
if I
try to share to Christians, I mean, it's like starting a war. You know,
yes,
as soon as you undermine Galatians and Colossians, you know what I mean?
You're
starting
right.
a war.
That's correct.
But
yes.
I hope, you know.
What's interesting about that, Paul, before we go on, what's interesting about that is if any Christian would actually read Galatians through, particularly in the Greek, just get an interlinear so that you know what the Greek words say, and they were to read Galatians from start to finish in the Greek from an interlinear, they would run away from it as fast as their little souls would carry them, because it is so obnoxious, so obviously poorly written, so clearly untrue that it's amazing that people have bought into a myth that Paul's horribly written, internally conflicting, anti-Torah letters were inspired by the very God that Paul contradicted. But yet they do, and they'll go to war, a war of words, over anybody that dare tells them the truth. Paul, I know you've been patient and holding on. We've come to a commercial break. When we come back and rejoin, we'll have 20 minutes uninterrupted. Would you mind holding, and we'll talk about your perspective and questions when we return to Shatteringness?
I'll be waiting. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. We'll return to Shatteringness after the commercial breaks, and we'll continue to have discussion with a very interesting individual who bears the name Paul. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shatteringness. We're having a conversation with Paul, who is called in from Ontario. And Paul has begun by mentioning that the truth, when revealed about either Yahweh or on the opposite side, negatively about Paul, is so shocking in today's world. It almost asks as if the truth is perceived as poison by those who have been poisoned by the lie of religion, particularly Christianity. So go ahead, Paul. I promised you the floor was yours.
Yeah, okay. So what happens is, just a quick comment, that last week, talking with this Christian, he tells me, everything is in the Torah and the feast of Yahweh, and everything is nailed to the cross, Colossians 2:16. But, I hope some Christians listen to this program. What I did before I went to your books is this. I consider the scriptures that you presented, like Psalm 119, mm-hmm. Psalm 19, right. You know, Deuteronomy, Exodus, Leviticus.
Right.
And you know what? I never saw, for example, this Shuv. Psalm 119 on one page. Mm-hmm. David calls words of Yahweh the truth.
Right.
Three times on the same page.
Right.
I've never seen that before. I said, if he calls it the truth, the question in my mind, how can Yahweh change his mind mm-hmm. and nail everything to the cross, and then in the new covenant in Jeremiah 31, put in our hearts, and nail it again, and put in our hearts. It's stupid.
Oh, it's stupid. It's stupid.
It's nonsense. Yeah, stupid.
You know, I wish that the Torah had been nailed to the upright pole upon which Yahusha was hanging on Passover, because if it had been nailed there and people read it and they made the association between what he was doing there on Passover and what had been said in the Torah, they might make the connection between the two. But unfortunately, they don't. They think that the Torah was annulled. Now, what's interesting, Paul, under this discussion, is Yahusha said exactly the opposite. Yahusha said, don't think that I came to annul the Torah. Don't think I did so. I came to fulfill it, to enable it, to honor its promises. I am the living embodiment, in other words, of the Torah. And so how a Christian can be so stupid, I mean, it's just stupid, to believe that Paul was authorized to annul the Torah, to come up with this stupid notion that the Torah was nailed to the cross so that it has been done away with, and that the God who authorized the Torah, the God who inspired the Torah, the God who authored the Torah has gone to Paul to contradict him and to annul everything he stood for. How utterly stupid do you have to be to believe that kind of a lie? And that's what Christians believe.
Yeah, if you in it, you don't see it. And now you see when I make these discussions,
right.
I'm talking about words of Yahweh from the books, like, you know, prophets and we talk about you know, Galatians, Colossians, Corinthians. We talk about two different gods, two different, almost like you know.
Oh, totally different. Yeah, Paul. In fact, the point that you made is one of the most relevant if somebody is informed and rational, which is that Christians will claim that their New Testament is authorized by Jeremiah 31. It's actually Jeremiah 31, which means Yahweh uplifts. But they claim that it is the introduction of their new covenant or New Testament. And yet, what Yahweh says there is that he is going to renew and reaffirm his covenant, not with the Agoyim church, Gentile church, but instead with Yisrael and Yehudah, which completely undermines the church's claim of replacement theology. And then he says that there is going to be a difference between this reaffirming of the covenant and the covenant as it existed with Abraham. And the difference is that he says, I'm going to write my Torah inside of you. Personally, Yahweh is going to write his Torah inside of us. Right now, the Torah is something we can choose to ignore, to reject, to accept, to study. You know, the choice is ours, which is what we want to do with Yahweh's Torah. But he says when he returns, the Torah is going to be placed right inside of us, perfectly written by Yahweh. How is it possible that you can have a New Testament based upon annulling the Torah when Yahweh reaffirms his covenant, he's going to write the Torah inside of us? How is that even remotely rational?
Mm-hmm.
Right. It isn't. I mean, Jeremiah 31, the very passage that Christians claim gives them the basis for their New Testament, completely destroys the religion. All you have to do is read the testimony provided in Jeremiah 31, and Christianity is gone. Its premise is completely blown up and destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah, it's a shocking to me. And
like I said, I mean, to present that message is almost what to Moses. It's probably impossible. They won't believe it.
I know. The most amazing thing is you can cite Jeremiah 31 to a Christian. which absolutely and completely disproves their religion, and they can't process the information. You can cite, as I've done a number of times, the 19th Psalm to them, or the 119th, which speak of the enduring perfection of the Torah, and that it's for all people, for all time, that it's the perfect solution for all problems, and that it is the one and only source of our relationship with Yahweh and our vindication. And even the testimony of God is insufficient.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when God says that Passover is an invitation for us to meet forever in all places for all people,
mm-hmm.
they ignore it.
Yeah.
You know, God's testimony is not sufficient to persuade a person that's infected by religion.
Right. Right. So now, if I may, I would like to change the topic, because
please.
I wanted to okay. this question also regarding ancient civilizations.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, sometimes I like to listen to Coast to Coast, George Norrie. He's got this interesting.
Yes.
Yes. I try to. And I wonder what would happen if you appear on this program.
Actually, I was. I did two shows with George Norrie.
Oh, I did.
And one with Art Bell. Art Bell had the Coast to Coast show and built the brand long before Art Norrie. And in fact, it was Art Bell said, "I'll come back and make a guest appearance on my show, but on one condition. I want." He wanted me, and you know, my real name isn't Yad. It's Craig Wynn. He says, "I want Craig Wynn to be my guest, because what he wanted to do is speak out against the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq." And I did a show very early on, maybe now 10 years ago, with Coast to Coast, 3 hours with George Norrie, where I explained that our invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq would end up as a disaster, that we did not understand the situation and that we were going to make a bad situation worse in both countries. And I methodically explained the nature of Islam and why what we were doing was going to blow up in our faces, and predicted everything that resulted in those wars back with George Norrie 8 to 10 years ago, and then again with Art Bell about 6 years ago. And so, and I've been on Coast to Coast, the all-night program.
Okay, I didn't know. I have to go back then to try to find it. Okay, I'm sure that would be right on time still, if you could present this message to
people. Oh, of course, yeah. Everything I predicted, everything I said then is as applicable today as it was then. It all transpired exactly as I said it would. And it's not because I'm smart. It's because I've read the playbook of the Muslims. I've read the playbook of Yahweh. You put them together, and you realize one's a lie, one's the truth, and so it's really easy to see what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. So now going back to this
issue,
like, you know what they present? Well, some of them present this Anunnaki theory, you know, Zachariah Sitchin, you know, that Anunnaki created people for different reasons and stuff like that. And on the other hand, we've got so many of those structures like pyramids in Egypt or Stonehenge, all those things. So some of them say that we had very intelligent civilizations before us.
Yeah.
But this technology is all gone, because we cannot even build a pyramid like this today.
I think the conspiracy claims are a nutsy. The means to build the pyramids is not difficult. I know it's always shown with sand ramps, but they use levers and pulleys. Extremely easy to lift stones via levers and pulleys, and man has been cutting stone for a very long period of time. There is no indication whatsoever that this inclination to worship the sun as God and to align things with the celestial path of the Earth's rotation is something that extraterrestrials had to inspire, or that there were profoundly brilliant civilizations. We have the writings of the Egyptians, and 99% of what the Egyptians wrote about is untrue, false. We have the writings even of the Greeks, even of Socrates and Plato, and most of what they professed is known to be untrue. And you look at the Babylonians, what the Babylonians built and what they believed is very similar to what was built in Egypt. So I don't think there's any basis to it. As it relates to the possibility that extraterrestrials were here and that they somehow inspired various things, I think it's utter nonsense. A physical being cannot travel the distances, even if a physical being was on a planet that is part of the Milky Way galaxy. There's no way for them to come to our solar system. It's just the nature of matter and energy, the nature of time. When you understand the universe as it's actually composed, you realize that until we receive Yahweh's promised benefit, which is to be transformed into light, that the universe is unexplorable. So I think there's a zero possibility that those things occurred, and you've just got conspiracy folks that, and it's a very tiny segment of society. Now, here I'm talking on a network that it was built on the backbone of conspiracy, but it's a really tiny percentage of the world's population that buys into the conspiracy. Fortunately for George and Ori, there's enough of them up late at night to make each other think that it's is some truth in it. But the you asked me my opinion, and I have I've done a lot of study on the possibilities of space travel, and I've done a lot of studies on relativity and what it means and the relationship between energy and matter, and I've concluded absolutely that there is it's impossible for a being, a physical being from any other solar system to come to Earth. And I've also concluded that there is a natural explanation for everything that has been built in history, and that the building was not nearly as difficult as we have made it out to be. We do have another segment left. You're welcome to stay, Paul. That is your call. I don't know what your time is, and we can discuss this further or any other question that you may have or issue. But anyway, we are going to the commercial break. We'll be back with the last segment of Shattering Myths in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We were talking about, with Paul, the potential for somehow civilizations prior to recorded history being somehow inspired to be particularly sophisticated. And yet what we find is that recorded history begins exactly when Yahweh said it would begin, begins about 3,000 years ago. The oldest text that we have that we can read from these civilizations date back to about 2,500 to 2,800 BCE. And they're all quite similar. They're all written on behalf of religious entities trying to promote the same sun god religion. The reason, by the way, Paul, that I said that it's impossible for there to be UFOs in the sense of aliens visiting here is that for matter to reach the speed of light, you need an infinite amount of energy. And then when a physical object is accelerated to the speed of light, it becomes infinitely massive. And so there is no way for a physical being or a physical object to travel at the speed of light, and yet you would have to travel faster than the speed of light to make travel to other solar systems and other galaxies possible. Which means that once you understand the nature of light, the nature of velocity, the nature of mass, and their interaction between the two, you realize that it is a physical impossibility.
Thank you. Thank you for the answer. Can I have one more question?
Sure, go ahead.
Different topic altogether.
Okay.
Famous rapture.
Yeah.
Many deceptive doctrines. Matthew 24, one is left, one is taken.
Yep.
Rapture, not rapture.
Right. Yeah. The term rapture comes from Paul's letters. It's from harpazo. It means to viciously snatch away. Yosha uses the term in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 7 to condemn Paul as the wolf in sheep's clothing, snatching souls away from the Torah. Uses the same word. So there is no rapture. And Paul, by the way, was wrong, because when Paul proclaimed his rapture, he said that he would be one of those who would be raptured. So it was going to occur in his lifetime, which means that on his lone prophecy, he got it wrong. There is a harvest. The harvest Yosha is referring to in the Olivet Discourse in Matthew, in late Matthew, Matanyah. He actually spoke Hebrew, but it's translated as paralambano, and paralambano means to reach out by the hand. Yahweh has a lot to say about a harvest of saved souls. Most of what he has to say is an association with Teruah, which is the next of the invitations to meet with God to be fulfilled. He speaks in Yeshayah 17, in particular, Isaiah 17, of this Teruah harvest being a gleaning, which means it's a smaller secondary harvest. There's not going to be a lot of people that will be gleaned in association with Teruah. He tells us that there will be approximately 4,000 Goyim members of the covenant and about 3,000 Israelite members of the covenant that are going to be gleaned or harvested at this day. So it's going to be an event that's going to have God call about 7,000 individuals home. The timing of it is on Teruah, but Yahweh says that it's going to occur in concert with the world diminishing Israel at the waist, giving the Mormons, the Muslims, the West Bank. And right before the Islamic assault that will follow when Israel becomes indefensible, that it's after one and before the other is when this harvest takes place. If I were guessing, Paul and I, and, you know, we're all in a position we ought to think these things through, I think it will occur on the gleaning, the small harvest is going to take place on Teruah in our year 2026, the last year, the fall when the tribulation begins.
And the rest? And the rest of us, the people?
The rest of the people will endure the tribulation. God goes into great lengths to describe what's going to occur throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. The first aspect is an all-Islamic war against Israel. Israel is indefensible. God blows the Muslims away. He then condemns the United States for its role, establishes his standard for all to see in Israel, particularly in Jerusalem, calls his people to make a choice, the election. Are you going to choose Yahweh? Are you going to choose the adversary? And he goes on to talk about what transpires in the last 3.5 years.